Well, this week we will continue with Daniel chapter 9, and just a brief overview of what this chapter is. Daniel has read, obviously, multiple books because he mentions it in verse 2, but specifically the book of Jeremiah, who was a contemporary of Daniel. He was living in Daniel's day, but he had written his book before Daniel got his book written. And so, but Daniel was reading in there and studying Jeremiah specifically, but I'm confident he was studying all of the prophets of these books, of whatever this included. They don't know what it is in this verse 2 by the books, but there was more than the book of Jeremiah. And he obviously was studying everything very diligently, but then he came to Jeremiah and he came across that God had told him that the Israelites would only be in Babylonian, in this captivity that started out to be Babylonian. Now they're in the Medo-Persian captivity. But anyway, it started out with this Babylonian captivity for 70 years. So that's this captivity would only last 70 years. Then they would be returned to Jerusalem. Well, he did the calculations and he knew that this 70 years was coming to an end. And what he knew is that the Israelites had not repented. That it was like they hadn't learned anything. They'd been in captivity for 70 years. They were still just as unrighteous, still disobedient to God. Now, it's not mentioned. I don't know if paganism, here they are among the pagan, what were the Babylonians, but now the still pagan Medo-Persians. I don't know if any of this paganism and things have slipped in part of it, but it's just a general unrighteousness and sinning against God. So Daniel is very, very concerned that because of that, their unrighteousness, that God will not be able to return them to Jerusalem. So that's what this prayer is about. And as we'll read it here, it's very earnest, heart-rending. Daniel pours his heart out to God, pleading for him to please be able to return us to Jerusalem. And anyway, then just to finish out the chapter, while Daniel is still praying and pleading, he gets interrupted by Gabriel, the angel Gabriel. And the angel Gabriel tells him, here it is, verse 23. I have come to tell you, this is Gabriel telling Daniel, for you are greatly beloved. So, Daniel has Daniel is very beloved by God. So, very high consideration. You know, Daniel is, Kaufman said that Daniel, which now this isn't something that we didn't already know, but he's one of the greatest of the prophets. He is right up there at the top. And anyway, but he had a very high regard and very beloved by God. And so he interrupts him, and God, through the angel Gabriel, had a vision, a prophecy that he wanted to give him, and that is the now known as the famous 70 weeks prophecy. And that was about the time frame that, yes, they were going to be returned to Jerusalem. Yes, they were going to rebuild Jerusalem. They were going to rebuild the temple. And according to that time frame of when the order was come out to rebuild the temple, then there the 70 weeks, which is thought to be 490 years would be able to extrapolate to the death of the Messiah, which it gets cut short on that last. So it's 3.5 years off of that 490 years, which is 70 times 7, 490 years. And that is, Kaufman spells it out here, how that is the time, goes to 30 AD when the Messiah was sacrificed. So that's what, ultimately Daniel gets his answer, that because obviously they're going to have to be returned to Jerusalem to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple and get the order to rebuild it. And then the Messiah is going to come in this 490 year time frame, and he's going to be cut off, which now we know that means he was sacrificed, and it was for sins, and for the end of sins, for the end of transgressions. All of these statements are phrases are put in this 70 weeks prophecy that we'll be looking to in the next week or two. So, any comments or questions? Right. Yes, and Solomon's temple got destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar because of this Babylonian captivity. And then, yes, then they're going to build it. And now, with this time, they're going to build it, but it's not known as the Great Temple as in Jesus' day, because it's King Herod that starts to restore it and make it what was known as one of the wonders of the ancient world, has become to be known now. And I guess it was even then. And we know that from the apostles. They were so, had so much pride. All of the Israelites had pride. We have this great building, and Kaufman reported, I read through him, that Josephus recorded that even the Romans, you know, we all know that the Romans had a great pride. They were great engineers, great architects, and they built great buildings, and they recognized and appreciated great architecture. And they recognized that temple as such great architecture that Titus ordered that you destroy Jerusalem, we're going to ransack them, but you leave the temple alone. That was the order that he gave his men. But it didn't happen, obviously, because guess what? God wanted that temple. So even though the a destroying king, a general, had given the order not to destroy the temple, God had already stated, you know, through Jesus, God the Son, had already prophesied there's not going to be one stone left upon another. And so logistically how it happened, however it was, there was a fire that got started in the temple, and there was a lot of wood, and then so the wood caught fire, the temple burned, and they had gold plated all over the stones of the temple, and the fire was hot enough that it melted the gold, and the gold went in all of the cracks of all the stone. So after it burned, then the Roman soldiers were able to take the what they call the booty, the plunderings, and so they went in with pickaxes and chisels and went and got all the gold that they could salvage. And so then they destroyed all. That's what happened to all the stones. They all got dismantled by chiseling them to pieces. And they got the gold out of it. And then the rubble from the stones got put into the famous Roman roads. Yes, got taken off, carried off into the Roman roads. And that's why they can't find it. There's no trace of it. It's all underneath people's feet. So they're not one stone left upon another, and it would never be put back together. It was, they were carried all off as rubble and used it. Yes. Yes. That's a great thought. This was symbolic of God. It was destroyed, and now it's trampled underfoot. It's done away with. That is it. That was the end of the temple.
And then the Roman roads were built.
And they're still there today.
Yes, still there. Still there today. So I'm confident. Where, you know, we don't know where exactly it was, but yeah, or where, you know, it was just a bunch of gravel by that time. And but anyway, wherever it got put, and probably right there around Jerusalem area, whatever roads they were building at the time, that's where it went. And yeah, it's still there today, and they're walking under it, don't even know it. They're looking, you know, they're looking for where, what the location of the temple. Well, if you want the temple stones, just look on the roads, because that's what happened to it. Yes, yes, that Josephus recorded all of this. And fortunately, I haven't read any of Josephus myself, but I haven't had to. Yeah, it's very, our granddad, dad's dad, studied and read Josephus. He'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he would be reading Josephus and studying that. But I never have, but I haven't had to, because Kaufman studied him and read him, and he reports the main important parts. And so I get a good amount of what he said that pertained to these particular chapters and books that we're studying. And so I haven't had to wade through, because he wrote a massive amount of material. So I get it just out of Kaufman and get the true meat of it and the importance of it. So that saves. I never would read Josephus. It's too much.
Yeah.
So I'm thankful for Kaufman to give me the Cliff's Notes version.
Well, I wonder what started the fire.
They don't know. They don't know.
There's so many sacrifices in there.
Yes. Potentially that. But now they were in war and all. But anyway, you know, they had all these candles, the menorah, all these candle things everywhere. Probably it got bumped over and knocked over. They think it was an accident. Now, they don't think anybody set it on fire on purpose, but just an accident. But then, you know, it goes, and that's right. Yes. So that is very interesting, but that is what this is talked about. That is what this 70 weeks prophecy at the end of this chapter is. But this first 3/4 of this chapter is Daniel pleading in prayer that God is able to release them back to Jerusalem. So that's where we will pick up here. I will reiterate verse 3 that we ended with last week, because this is where it starts. Daniel says, "Then I set my face toward the Lord God to make requests by prayer and supplications with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes." Verse 4. "And I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession and said, O Lord, great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant and mercy with those who love him and with those who keep his commandments." Okay. So, God is great and awesome, and he keeps his covenants, his contracts, with those who keep his commandments. See, a covenant is a contract, and we know that a contract is a two-way. A promise is only a one-way commitment, to where if I promise you something, then I'm the only one that's obligated to keep that. You would not be committed to one thing. Now, if I enter with you a contract, well, then we are both obligated. And that's what a covenant is a contract. And so, he keeps his end of the bargain with those who keep his commandments. That is the humans. And in this case, it's the Israelites part. So, he starts out this great prayer by saying that we know that you keep your covenants, but only with the righteous and in the obedience of the people. And that's where the contention is, because he's going to start right off the bat in this next verse. That's our problem. We have not kept up our part of the covenant, of the contract. So, verse 5, we have sinned and committed iniquity. And Kaufman points out in his commentary, notice the we in these. It's not they. It's not those Israelites, my fellow citizens, Israelites. It's none of that. It's we. He includes himself in all of this. This is how humble that Daniel is. So, verse 5, we have sinned and committed iniquity. We have done wickedly and rebelled, even by departing from your precepts and your judgments. So what he spells out the whole basis of this prayer right here in verses 4 and 5, right off the bat, by saying, we know that you keep your covenants, and we know that your covenant says that we're going to be returned. But that's only if we keep our end of the contract, and we have not. We've sinned. We've committed iniquity. We're wicked. We have rebelled. We've departed from your precepts and your judgments. So, verse 6, he continues, neither have we heeded your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings and our princes, and our fathers, and all the people of the land. This is the problem, and this is what has very much alarmed Daniel. Because of all of this disobedience and unrighteousness toward God, the Israelites have, even though nearly 70 years have passed, for whatever reason, they have not picked up on the problem, on what got them there to begin with, and worked on it. They should have been working on this whole 70 years. And there have been other prophets that, and Daniel mentions other prophets that they have been talking as the oracles of God to them all this time, and they've ignored the prophets. So not only Jeremiah's teaching and writings that they've ignored, it's been the prophets walking among them in that day. Daniel wasn't the only one. God had several other prophets, and they've ignored them all and stayed unrighteous, unfortunately. Any questions or comments on this?